This episode is brought to you by Accounting Plus. We've heard about career killers, but how about a killer career? Accounting has got it all. You'll have flexibility, great pay, and the kind of lifestyle you've always dreamed of. If that's not enough, you'll have the opportunity to make a difference by using your detective skills to investigate financial mysteries. Want in? Accounting Plus provides free resources that'll help guide you to a successful career in accounting and personal freedom. Do more. Live more. Visit joinaccountingplus.com.
I'm Tanya Mosley. In 1987, my sister Anita vanished without a trace. Decades later, thanks to DNA, we found her. But that's only the beginning of the story. She Has a Name is a new audio documentary that explores the search for redemption, confronting trauma, and healing in the face of unimaginable loss. Subscribe now to Truth Be Told Presents She Has a Name, where every revelation brings us closer to the truth.
It feels like we're all being told to go on this diet, take that supplement. Ozempic will give you depression, but you know what'll cure that? Weed. Or you could try to balance your hormones. At Science Versus, we're like,
what the f*** is going on?
Forget the crap online and listen to Science Versus. Just the facts. Oh, and a bunch of stupid jokes.
What is a ghost's favorite fruit? Booberries.
That's Science VS. New season out on Spotify soon.
Due to the graphic nature of these killers' crimes, listener discretion is advised. This episode includes dramatizations and discussions of murder and assault that some people may find offensive. While we always issue content warnings before our shows, the subjects you are about to hear about may be the most disturbing yet. We advise extreme caution, especially for children under the age of 13.
Did you at any time ever use an ice pick?
No, sir.
You struck Miss Lamp with a sledgehammer. You recall the sledgehammer which was introduced?
Yes, sir, I recall it.
Was that true?
No, sir.
If you ever wondered what a serial killer lying under oath sounded like, now you know. What you just heard was part of Lawrence Bittaker's testimony from his murder trial in January 1981. But lying under oath in a court of law was far from Lawrence Bittaker's worst offense. The Miss Lamp being referred to in that excerpt was 13-year-old Leah Lamp, who along with her 15-year-old friend Jackie Gilliam was kidnapped and held in captivity for over 2 days in the San Gabriel Mountains before being murdered. Leah had been humiliated, brutally tortured, and forced to pose for pornographic photographs. But unlike her friend Jackie, Leah Lamp was not raped. Apparently, her kidnappers found her to be too, quote, overweight for their liking. After stabbing Jackie Gilliam in both ears with ice picks, Lawrence Bittaker strangled her to death. Then he shouted at Leah, quote, "You wanted to stay a virgin, now you can die a virgin," and proceeded to strike her head with a sledgehammer before strangling her with a wired coat hanger and pliers until he believed she was dead. But when Leah opened her eyes once more, Bittaker's accomplice, Roy Norris, bludgeoned her repeatedly while Bittaker strangled her to death.
Leah Lamp and Jackie Gilliam were the third and fourth victims of Lawrence Bittaker and Roy Norris, a.k.a. the Toolbox Killers, who terrorized the citizens of Southern California during their five-month killing spree from June to October 1979, in which they murdered five teenage girls ranging from ages 13 to 18.
It was during that five-month period, on September 30th, 1979, that a young woman by the name of Robin Robeck had mace sprayed in her face by two Caucasian males in their 30s, who then dragged her into their van and raped her repeatedly. Eventually, the men released Robin, who reported the assault to the authorities, but at the time, police were unable to identify her assailants.
But there was something unusual about Robin Robeck's case in the context of Roy Norris and Lawrence Bittaker's other crimes at the time. They didn't release their victims after assaulting them.
They tortured and killed them, just like they did to Leah Lamp, Jackie Gilliam, and three other young women. While neither man was ever officially charged for her rape, Robin Robeck played a crucial role in the conviction of Lawrence Bittaker, currently on death row at San Quentin State Prison, and Roy Norris, now serving out a life sentence at the Richard J. Donovan Correctional Facility.
So how did law enforcement finally catch up with Roy Norris and Lawrence Bittaker? What role did Robin Robeck play? And how did one former inmate from the very same prison where they got started help bring their murderous rampage to an end? We'll discuss all that and plenty more on today's episode of Serial Killers. Hi, I'm Greg Polson, and you're listening to Serial Killers, a new podcast diving into the minds and motives of some of the most notorious serial killers. This week, we continue our look into the minds of Lawrence Bittaker and Roy Norris, better known as the Toolbox Killers. If you want to listen to any episodes of Serial Killers, you can find them all in your favorite podcast directory. Don't forget to subscribe. You can also listen on our website, parcast.com, spelled P-A-R-C-A-S-T.com. A new episode comes out every Monday. Visit our Facebook page, Parcast, to join the conversation.
A census taker once tried to test me. I ate his liver with some fava beans and a nice Chianti.
Jonathan Demme's 1991 Best Picture winner, The Silence of the Lambs, used the Bittaker-Norris case for research during the making of the film. When asked if he had ever seen the film, this is what Lawrence Bittaker had to say.
I've seen bits of it, but those types of movies don't appeal to me. I have no preoccupation with murder mysteries or sexual assault mysteries. I can't relate to the movie. It's too wacky.
Perhaps a movie about a killer who ate his victims and wore their skin felt too wacky for Lawrence Bittaker's taste. However, one aspect of the Bittaker-Norris case, clearly reflected in the Buffalo Bill killer in The Silence of the Lambs, is the killer's organized nature. To understand more about the role of organization in serial killers, I want to bring my co-host Vanessa into the conversation. It's important to note that Vanessa is not a psychologist or psychiatrist, but, like me, she's fascinated by the psychology of serial killers and has done a lot of research for the show. Hi, Vanessa.
Hi, Greg.
Previously on the podcast, we've discussed disorganized serial killers, but that wouldn't be an appropriate descriptor when it comes to Roy Norris and Lawrence Bittaker, correct?
That's right, Greg. Last week, we discussed the many practice runs that Norris and Bittaker acted out for over 2 months before they committed their first murder. This indicates the kind of meticulous planning that we tend to see in organized killers.
Can you refresh our listeners on the difference between organized and disorganized killers?
Of course, absolutely. The FBI has identified three distinct categories for serial killers based on the way they carry out their murders: medical killers, organized killers, and disorganized killers. Understanding which category a serial killer falls into helps law enforcement to investigate their crimes and bring them to justice. The organized serial killer tends to plan out the details of their crimes well in advance of committing them and go to great lengths to cover up any incriminating evidence, which is why the organized killer is the most difficult kind of serial killer for law enforcement to track down and capture. They're extremely methodical and usually highly intelligent.
And we know Lawrence Bittaker possessed a near-genius level IQ of 138.
Exactly. Plus, we know that organized killers tend to scout out their victims until they find the perfect target. Their victims tend to possess common characteristics that suit the killer's preferences. For example, an organized killer might only seek out white women within a narrow age range. Organized killers then pick up their victim, usually involving a ploy that lures them involuntarily by gaining their sympathy, and take them to a secluded location to commit the murder. Sound familiar?
Yes. Sounds like Norris and Bittaker fit the profile of an organized killer to a T. These guys had everything planned out, from which pickup line they used during the initial approach to where they dumped the body to ensure it wouldn't be found. I'm assuming that most organized killers would take the necessary precautions to make sure the body isn't found.
Usually, at first, at least until they want it to be.
Why would they want their victim's body to be found?
Well, while organized killers generally make sure to cover their tracks, they also take great pride in their skills, which they consider their work. So organized killers have a tendency to follow news stories about their crimes and keep up with the public reaction to their work.
And that was exactly what Lawrence Bittaker was hoping to do after he and Norris killed 16-year-old high school student and part-time waitress Shirley Lynette Ledford, their fifth and final victim.
But Shirley was also their first and only victim who wasn't picked up within their usual hunting ground along the Pacific Coast Highway and taken to the San Gabriel Mountains to be killed like the other four girls. By that time, Bittaker and Norris felt comfortable enough to expand their horizons, so to speak.
Exactly. They picked her up in a residential neighborhood in the San Fernando Valley and murdered her in their van.
Mm-hmm. That's partly because Bittaker had been somewhat disappointed that the bodies of the other girls had never been found, and his crimes hadn't received much attention in the press. Bittaker wanted desperately to read about himself in the paper, so he suggested to Norris that they leave Shirley Ledford's body on a residential lawn in Sunland, just to see what the public reaction would be.
And that's exactly what they did. After a jogger discovered Ledford's corpse the following morning, Lawrence Bittaker got exactly what he was hoping for, a media frenzy. At a press conference, police revealed a list of horrifying injuries that Ledford's autopsy uncovered. Petechial hemorrhage and compression marks on her neck confirmed strangulation as the cause of death. She received extensive blunt force trauma to the face, head, breasts, and left elbow, sustaining multiple fractures, and was sexually violated by her killers. Her vagina and rectum were severely torn by what police identified as pliers that were inserted inside of her. And with that, the press dubbed Shirley Ledford's murderer as the Toolbox Killer.
Well, that might have been what Lawrence Bittaker wanted, but it was also their first major error in keeping law enforcement in the dark about their crimes. Since none of the other victims' bodies had been found up until that point, they were just considered missing teenage girls. It was thought that they may have just been runaways. But once Bittaker and Norris left Shirley Ledford's corpse out in the open, law enforcement knew that they had a killer on the loose.
True. But putting Shirley Ledford on display isn't what did them in exactly. At that point, law enforcement might have known they had a killer on their hands, but lacked sufficient evidence to track them down. I actually find the real downfall of these guys to be rather ironic.
Do tell.
Well, as we discussed last week, Norris and Bittaker first became acquainted while serving time together in prison, where they confided in each other their sick, demented fantasies involving the torture, rape, and murder of teenage girls. A fantasy that they planned to live out once they both were released. But it was confiding in another acquaintance at the California Men's Colony, the very same prison where they first met, that ultimately brought down the Toolbox Killers. After Jimmy Dalton was released from the California Men's Colony, his old pal Roy Norris paid him a visit.
Perhaps it was Norris's friendship with Bittaker that reinforced a belief that criminals don't reform in prison.
Perhaps. Because Norris felt comfortable enough to tell Dalton in gruesome detail about what he and Bittaker had been up to over the past 5 months. But with two teenage daughters of his own, Dalton found this information unsettling and contacted his attorney, who advised Dalton to inform the authorities.
Los Angeles Police Department.
Hello, my name's Jimmy Dalton. I'd like to report 5 murders.
But with Dalton unable to provide the location of any of the victims' bodies, police weren't all that interested in what some ex-con claimed to have heard. Eventually, the report found its way onto the desk of Redondo Beach Detective Paul Bynum. After reviewing Dalton's claims, Detective Bynum matched his description of a woman who had been maced before being raped by Norris and Bittaker with the unsolved rape of Robin Robeck. Bynum dispatched an investigator to visit Robeck at her home in Oregon to show her a series of mugshots. Robin Robeck was able to positively identify 2 photos of Roy Norris and Lawrence Bittaker as those of the men who had kidnapped and raped her less than 2 months earlier on September 30th. Roy Norris was placed under surveillance by the Hermosa Beach Police Department. Within days, they observed him weighing out and bagging marijuana, which Norris intended to sell. On November 20th, 1979, Hermosa Beach police arrested Roy Norris for parole violation. Detective Bynum then directed the police dispatcher to request the Burbank police arrest Lawrence Bittaker at his motel on the Ramey warrant, which Bynum held.
Typically, when a police department wishes to acquire a warrant, they must submit a report to the district attorney, and if the DA feels there is sufficient evidence to file the case, they'll issue an arrest warrant. However, in certain cases, police agencies may bypass the DA and get a warrant issued directly by a judge. Such a warrant is known as a Ramey warrant.
What's the benefit of a Ramey warrant as opposed to a normal warrant?
Well, for one, it's much faster to get. But in this case, Bynum likely went directly to the judge because he feared that the DA would deny his request because there wasn't enough evidence to file a case. Remember, this seemed like a shot in the dark at the time. All Bynum was going on was the word of an ex-con and an out-of-state rape victim he'd never met when he arrested Lawrence Bittaker.
And while Bittaker contested the legality of his arrest and subsequent search of his motel room following his conviction, his appeal would be overturned by the court, noting that Bynum's warrant was acquired on the basis of Robin Robeck identifying Bittaker as her rapist in a photo lineup, providing law enforcement sufficient probable cause to make the arrest.
Despite Robeck identifying mugshots of Bittaker and Norris as her rapists, during an in-person police lineup, she was unable to make a positive identification. In the case summary for the People versus Lawrence Bittaker, the state writes, quote, "Ironically, despite defendant's many crimes, he was actually arrested for one which he may not have committed. Robin R. was unable to identify defendant in person. Her description of the interior of the van where she was held did not match defendant's van, and the manner of her kidnapping and rape differed from defendant's characteristic mode of operation. Consequently, defendant was not charged with the Robin R. crimes."
But by that point, it wouldn't make much of a difference for Bittaker and Norris. During a search of Bittaker's motel room, police found Polaroid photos of two girls who had been reported missing earlier that year, Jackie Gilliam and Andrea Hall. As we mentioned at the top of the show, Jackie Gilliam and her friend Leah Lamp were the third and fourth victims of Lawrence Bittaker and Roy Norris. Andrea Hall was their second.
Our story will continue in a moment after a brief message. This episode is brought to you by Accounting Plus. We've heard about career killers, but how about a killer career? Accounting has got it all. You'll have flexibility, great pay, and the kind of lifestyle you've always dreamed of. If that's not enough, you'll have the opportunity to make a difference by using your detective skills to investigate financial mysteries. Want in? Accounting Plus provides free resources that'll help guide you to a successful career in accounting and personal freedom. Do more. Live more. Visit joinaccountingplus.com. And now, back to serial killers.
On July 8th, just 2 weeks after the murder of Cindy Schaefer, Norris and Bittaker spotted 18-year-old Andrea Hall hitchhiking along the Pacific Coast Highway. Norris hid in the back of the van, giving Hall the impression that Bittaker was alone. After accepting Bittaker's offer of a soft drink from the cooler in the back of the van, Norris pounced on her. After quite a struggle, Norris eventually overpowered Hall by twisting her arm behind her back, causing her to scream in agony. Like Cindy Schaefer, Andrea Hall was bound and gagged and taken to the secret location off a fire road in the San Gabriel Mountains. Here, she was raped twice by Lawrence Bittaker and once by Roy Norris. But when Norris spotted car headlights approaching, they took her to a second location deeper in the mountains, where Bittaker forced Hall to walk naked up a hill and perform fellatio on him. Bittaker forced Andrea to pose for Polaroids. Then he took her to a third location within the San Gabriel Mountains, while Norris made a trip to the nearby liquor store. When Norris returned with the booze, Bittaker was alone and in possession of a few more Polaroids, which depicted Andrea Hall with facial expressions that Norris described as, quote, sheer terror. Bittaker told Norris that while Hall begged for her life, he challenged her to provide some, quote, good reasons why he shouldn't kill her, before thrusting an ice pick in her ear and into her brain. He then turned her over and thrust the ice pick into the other ear, stamping on it with his foot until the handle broke. Bittaker then manually strangled Andrea Hall until she was dead and tossed her body over a cliff. Ooh. Vanessa, previously on the show, we've discussed that it's not uncommon for serial killers to hold on to a keepsake or a trophy that belonged to their victims.
That's correct. These trophy items allow the killer to relive the murder and prolong the thrill they felt at the time.
So, do you think that in this case, the Polaroid served that same function?
Well, in the case of Andrea Hall begging for her life, I do. But typically, those kinds of items are more personal to the victim, such as Shirley Ledford's bracelet that police found in Roy Norris's home. But like we discussed on last week's show, these guys were attracted to young teenage girls who they constantly fantasize about overpowering. Remember, between searches of Norris and Bittaker's residences, Polaroids of nearly 500 teenage girls were confiscated by police, most of which had been taken without the girls' knowledge or consent. So while a few of these Polaroids might be keepsakes from their murder victims, most of them probably just served as pornographic material for Norris and Bittaker.
But these confiscated photographs did feature a total of 19 girls who had been reported missing. Though besides Andrea Hall and Jackie Gilliam, none of them had been successfully traced back to Bittaker and Norris.
Right, but it's very possible that Norris and Bittaker were responsible for more than just the deaths of the five girls they were charged for. At a press conference following their arrest, L.A. Sheriff Peter Pitches stated that Norris and Bittaker may have been responsible for the deaths of anywhere between 30 to 40 more people who would have been subjected to sadistic and barbaric abuse.
I suppose the only ones who know the actual number of murders for sure are Lawrence Bittaker and Roy Norris. And Roy Norris had a different story from the one the police were putting together at this point. At his preliminary hearing on November 30th, Roy Norris was beginning to display visible signs of distress. When questioned by Detective Bynum and Prosecutor Stephen Kay, Norris flat out denied any involvement in the murders, rapes, and disappearances of several teenage girls. But after Norris was presented with the mounting evidence that suggested otherwise, he began to confess. While shifting culpability onto Bittaker, Norris casually laid out their routine.
We'd drive along the highway by the beach. If we saw a girl that looked good, we'd come up, try to get them to come with us. We'd flirt a little, offer them a ride, some pot or a cold drink from the cooler. Most of them said no, but there were four who said yes, came along by their own choice. One of them, first one, we had to force her in. Larry grabbed her off the sidewalk.
And what would you do when you got them in the van?
Tie them up. Have our way with them. We'd beat them with pliers most of the time. Larry was the one who'd killed them, though. Liked to strangle them with a coat hanger around their throats. There was one girl, Leah. I hit her head with a sledgehammer a couple times, but it was Larry who killed her.
Additional details provided by Norris further corroborated his account of the murders.
First girl, Cindy. She was coming from church or something, I think, when Larry got her. Pulled her into the van and one of her shoes fell right off. And the last one, Larry knew her. Liked her, too. He used to go to the restaurant where she waited tables. Asked her out on a date once. But she turned him down.
Norris also related that Bittaker's level of brutality increased with each girl who they successfully lured into their van.
I don't doubt it. On the tape of their final victim's torture, Shirley Ledford can be heard pleading with the men to end her life so that her unbearable agony could come to an end.
Why do you think Bittaker acted in this way, Vanessa?
An increasing level of brutality with each victim is actually a staple of the thrill-seeking serial killer, especially for those who get sexually aroused by dominating and brutalizing their victims. You can think about killing for these people as something similar to a drug addiction. The threshold for reaching the level of stimulation they felt their first time rises with each victim. So Bittaker's increasing brutality was him chasing a high.
And law enforcement was getting ready to put that chase to a permanent end. But even with Norris' confession, prosecutors still needed the victims' bodies to make a strong case. So Roy Norris decided to strike a plea deal with the prosecution. He agreed to testify against Lawrence Bittaker in order to escape the death penalty. In addition, Norris agreed to return with detectives to the San Gabriel Mountains to search for the bodies of those girls he confessed to abducting and killing.
Hey! Over here! I think I found something!
The skeletal remains of Jackie Gilliam and Leah Lamp were discovered at the bottom of the canyon, spread out across an area of several hundred feet in diameter. An ice pick was still lodged in the skull of Jackie Gilliam, and multiple indentations found on Leah Lamp's skull was evidence of the sledgehammer blows Norris claimed to have inflicted on her. Despite the extensive searches, the bodies of Cindy Schaefer and Andrea Hall were never found. But with the remains of at least three victims, including Shirley Ledford and the sworn testimony of Roy Norris, prosecutors now had what they needed to bring Lawrence Bittaker to trial.
After examining Lawrence Bittaker and Roy Norris, forensic psychiatrist Ronald Markman said of the sadistic duo, quote, "They lack the internal prohibitions or conscience that keep most of us from giving full expression to our most primitive and sometimes violent impulses."
What does he mean by "our" exactly? He's not implying that everyone possesses the same violent impulses that serial killers like Norris and Bittaker possessed, is he?
Actually, Greg, that's exactly what he's implying.
Whoa, wait. Hold on. Now, I could never kill anyone, and certainly not with such brutality.
I know, it's difficult to accept. Most of our listeners are probably thinking the same thing. There's no way I could ever do something so evil. The trouble is, too often we think of serial killers as monsters, but they're people. Sick and demented people, no doubt, but they're people just like you and me. These primitive and sometimes violent impulses that Markman refers to is what depth psychologists and Jungian psychoanalysts would call the shadow, a term coined by renowned psychologist Carl Jung. The shadow might be better understood as the dark side of every human being, rejected and suppressed by our conscious egos into our deep unconscious. Jung believed that in order for an individual to understand themselves, they must accept their shadow and incorporate it into their conscious lives in order to deal with the shadow in others. As Jung once wrote in his book, Psychology and Religion, quote, "Unfortunately, there can be no doubt that man is, on the whole, less good than he imagines himself or wants to be. Everyone carries a shadow, and the less it is embodied in the individual's conscious life, the blacker and denser it is," end quote. He believed the shadow was linked to our earlier primitive animal instincts, or in his words, the shadow is the invisible saurian tail that man still drags behind him.
I'm still not sure I understand.
Well, okay, think about it like this. Have you ever been cutting up food with a knife and suddenly became aware that you could stab the person next to you if you wanted to? Or maybe you've looked over the edge of a high balcony and thought about what would happen if you jumped?
Well, I guess. But those are just momentary thoughts. I would never actually act on it.
Exactly, because the vast majority of us have, in Markman's words, internal prohibitions or conscience that hold us back from giving in to these dark impulses. So while serial killers may have a mental disorder that makes these impulses stronger and less resistible, it's not the mental disorder that creates that impulse for violence and destruction. According to Jung, that dark potential is in all of us. And under a different set of circumstances, it very well may come out. In times of war, for example, we see how ordinary people can become capable of committing terrible atrocities. We saw it emerge in the murderous totalitarian societies of the 20th century, such as Nazi Germany and the Soviet Union. As Jung writes, quote, "The change of character brought about by the uprush of collective forces is amazing. A gentle and reasonable being can be transformed into a maniac or savage beast. One is always inclined to lay the blame on external circumstances, but nothing could explode in us if it had not been there. As a matter of fact, we are constantly living on the edge of a volcano, and there is, so far as we know, no way of protecting ourselves from a possible outburst that will destroy everybody within reach. It is certainly a good thing to preach reason and common sense, but what if you have a lunatic asylum for an audience or a crowd in a collective frenzy? There is not much difference between them, because the madman and the mob are both moved by impersonal, overwhelming forces," end quote. Additionally, he concluded in his book, On the Psychology of the Unconscious, quote, It is a frightening thought that man also has a shadow side to him, consisting not just of little weaknesses and foibles, but of a positively demonic dynamism. The individual seldom knows anything of this. To him, as an individual, it is incredible that he should ever, in any circumstances, go beyond himself. But let these harmless creatures form a mass, and there emerges a raging monster. And each individual is only one tiny cell in the monster's body, so that for better or worse, he must accompany it on its bloody rampages, and even assist it to the utmost. Having a dark suspicion of these grim possibilities, man turns a blind eye to the shadow side of human nature." End quote. Maybe Roy Norris and Lawrence Bittaker lacked an ideological rationalization for their crimes like the Nazis, but they had each other. And that was all they needed to bring out their collective shadow. And just like with the Nazis, the result was the same. Needless suffering inflicted upon the innocent, which is a good rough definition for evil.
That's pretty scary stuff, Vanessa. If everyone possesses the ability for evil, I'm glad at least we live in a society where evil doesn't go unpunished. Judge Thomas Fredericks presided over the trial of Lawrence Bittaker, which began on January 19, 1981. Judge Frederick set a precedent with this trial by allowing news cameras in the courtroom without the defendant's consent for the first time in California's history. The case of the Toolbox Killers received widespread media attention, sparked initially by the murder of Shirley Ledford. So the cameras were rolling when the star witness of the Bittaker trial took the stand, his partner in crime, Roy Norris. Norris divulged to the court in explicit detail of the five murders he and Bittaker committed from June to October of 1979. According to Norris, Bittaker had been the one who actually murdered their victims, with the exception of Shirley Ledford, who Norris admitted to strangling to death after Bittaker pressured him to do so, since he hadn't committed any of the other murders.
Bittaker's defense contended that Norris was the one who committed the murders after he and Bittaker would have sexual encounters with the victims, and that Bittaker only became aware of the murders when Norris informed him shortly after their arrest in November 1979. The defense pointed out that Bittaker had no history of acting violently, of course with the exception of his 1974 assault on Gary Louie, while Norris had a long criminal history of sexual violence prior to meeting Bittaker in 1977.
Well, for two guys who seem so close, they sure did turn on each other pretty quickly, once they found themselves in trouble.
Well, Bittaker putting the blame on Norris is no surprise. That was clearly retaliation for Norris putting the blame on him first.
And what about Norris? Was he just doing it to avoid the death penalty?
That was certainly a good incentive, but I believe Norris was feeling resentful towards Bittaker. Last week we mentioned how Bittaker had saved Norris from attacks by other inmates when they were first incarcerated together.
Mm-hmm.
Well, Norris claimed that because Bittaker had helped him out in prison, their, quote, prison code made him indebted to Bittaker, which is why he claimed to have participated in the murders. He also mentioned that he was high on drugs most of the time and was therefore unable to disobey Bittaker. And while that may not be all entirely true, as we mentioned in last week's episode, Bittaker was the more domineering personality, and Norris's schizoid personality made it difficult for him to stand up for himself in social situations. It's likely that Bittaker pressured Norris into agreeing to do some things he didn't want to do, like being the one to kill Shirley Ledford, for example. And for that, Norris was beginning to resent Bittaker. But he wasn't able to express that to Bittaker in a healthy way, and in turn, he got back at Bittaker by agreeing to testify against him. But even Norris's testimony wasn't the worst thing prosecutors had on Bittaker.
No, it was not. The most damning piece of evidence against Lawrence Bittaker was entered into trial on January 29th. The horrifying and shocking 17-minute audio recording of the rape and torture of Shirley Ledford.
During the search of Bittaker's motel room and van that turned up Polaroids of Andrea Hall and Jackie Gilliam, police also uncovered the tape recording of a young woman in distress, crying and pleading for mercy while being humiliated, tortured, and sexually abused. Shirley Ledford's mother identified the voice on the tape as being that of her only daughters, giving prosecutors a strong, concrete piece of evidence to connect Lawrence Bittaker to the very public murder of Shirley Ledford.
Our story will continue in a moment after a brief message.
And now let's continue our story.
Norris testified that Bittaker enjoyed listening to the tape while he was driving and considered the contents to be, quote, real funny. Over 100 people were present in the courtroom when the tape was played. Many had to walk out, and several members of the audience and jury wept openly. The court artist became physically ill during the recording and ran out of the courtroom while it played. Bittaker showed no signs of remorse, smiling throughout the recording.
As we discussed on last week's episode, Bittaker was a borderline psychotic who proved incapable of assuming any kind of personal responsibility for his actions. That resistance was clearly on display in the courtroom that day. Perhaps Bittaker thought that showing remorse would have been an acknowledgement of his guilt, and Bittaker was adamant about his innocence.
Well, his behavior in the courtroom that day certainly did not convince the jury of that. After the torture tape concluded, Judge Fredericks called for a recess. Deputy District Attorney Stephen Kay was reduced to tears as he exited the courtroom and addressed the reporters.
I just picture those poor girls. How alone they were when they died.
While the actual recording and direct transcript are far too graphic for our listeners, the court transcript summarized the contents of the tape as follows. Quote, after Bittaker had forced Shirley to fellate him, repeated sounds of an administered beating, interspersed with loud screams, can be heard as Bittaker savagely beat Shirley about the breasts and, to a lesser degree, head. Bittaker then extracted his pliers from the toolbox. Shirley then emits several high-pitched, prolonged screams and cries of agony as Bittaker alternately squeezes and twists her labia, clitoris, nipples, and breasts with the pliers. Bittaker then returns the pliers to the toolbox. Banging sounds can also be heard throughout, which are believed to have been made as Shirley came into contact with the walls and inner contents of the van as she writhed and flailed. End quote.
I touched Miss Ledford on the breast with the cold metal pliers. And if you listen to the tape, you'll hear those pliers being replaced in the toolbox a few seconds later.
Oh, what did you touch her on the breast for with a pair of pliers?
To shock her with the cold metal.
When Lawrence Bittaker took the stand on February 5th, he claimed that Shirley Ledford was not actually being tortured, but had agreed to scream theatrically for the tape. He shocked the jury when he referred to the tape contents as, quote, pillow talk. Bittaker also claimed that Andrea Hall agreed to pose nude for the Polaroids after accepting his offer of $200 to have sex with him. In fact, whenever the prosecution brought up a link between Bittaker and one of the victims, he claimed that they agreed to have sex with him for money, then he'd leave them alone with Norris, usually to walk them home, at which point Bittaker claimed Norris must have taken their lives.
Despite his involvement in prosecuting the Manson trials, Stephen Kay considers this to be the most horrific case he's ever prosecuted because the victims are all children. When Kay addressed the jury during closing statements, he apologized that he was only seeking the death penalty for Lawrence Bittaker. He said he wished the law would permit him to inflict the same degree of suffering on Bittaker as he had onto his victims. He referred to the case as, quote, one of the most shocking, brutal cases in the history of American crime, end quote, and described Bittaker as an excuse for a man as he held out pictures of the five murdered girls before the jury. He concluded with one final question.
If the death penalty is not appropriate in this case, then when will it ever be?
On February 17th, 1981, after 3 days of deliberation, the jury returned with a verdict. They found Lawrence Bittaker guilty on 5 counts of first-degree murder, 1 charge of conspiracy to commit first-degree murder, 5 charges of kidnapping, 9 charges of rape, 2 charges of forcible oral copulation, 1 charge of sodomy, and 3 charges of unlawful possession of a firearm. 2 days later, the jury convened to determine Bittaker's sentence. After just 90 minutes, they came back with the only sentence that seemed appropriate for Lawrence Bittaker, the death penalty. On February 24th, Judge Thomas Fredericks sentenced Lawrence Bittaker to die. Judge Fredericks also imposed an alternate sentence of 199 years and 4 months to take effect immediately in the event that Bittaker's death sentence was ever reverted to life in prison. Bittaker was transferred to the East Block of the San Quentin State Prison. where death row inmates are imprisoned until their death sentences to be carried out. Living in a 5-by-9-foot room with no natural lighting, Bittaker is awoken at 6 a.m. each morning by prison guards serving breakfast from a metal cart. At 7 a.m., prisoners may request to be allowed out to one of the 6 exercise yards. But Lawrence Bittaker had acquired some notoriety among the prison population. As it turns out, even murderers and rapists consider Bittaker a monster for torturing underage girls. So, due to hostility from other death row inmates, Lawrence Bittaker rarely leaves his cell. When he does, he must be escorted by 2 armed guards to keep the other inmates from harming him.
When Bittaker arrived on death row, there were 80 other prisoners condemned to death in California. However, Bittaker immediately appealed his sentence on the grounds that law enforcement did not have the proper authorization to search his Burbank motel room and van, and procedural errors during the search invalidated his conviction. His appeal was dismissed on June 22, 1989, by which point there were 247 condemned inmates in California. His initial execution date was set for December 29, 1989. However, Bittaker appealed this decision as well, and though the courts continued to uphold his sentence, Bittaker's ongoing appeals pushed his execution date back further and further. By 1992, when California carried out its first execution in over 25 years, the number of condemned inmates had swelled to 345.
This accumulation was the result of an ongoing struggle between the general public and California's judiciary over the legality of capital punishment. And despite Stephen Kay's insistence that if there's one person on death row who ought to be executed, it's Lawrence Bittaker, the growing number of condemned prisoners and bureaucratic complications have kept Lawrence Bittaker alive, who to this day remains an inmate at San Quentin on death row. Since his incarceration, Bittaker has filed more than 40 frivolous lawsuits over issues as trivial as being served a broken cookie and crushed sandwiches by the prison cafeteria, which he cited as examples of his being subjected to cruel and unusual punishment. In 1993, he was declared a vexatious litigant, a legal term to describe someone who continually files meritless lawsuits for the purposes of harassing an adversary. As a result of this declaration, Bittaker may no longer file suits without the express permission of an attorney or a judge.
This was partly because, unlike many of his fellow inmates, Bittaker had the intelligence to navigate the judicial system by reading law books in prison. Bittaker was given the test to become a prison guard by law enforcement officials who wanted to see how he would do. He received the highest score in the history of the federal system. The FBI also interviewed Bittaker on 2 occasions to gain insight into the psyche of a serial killer. Special Agent John Douglas stated that Lawrence Bittaker remains the most disturbing individual upon whom he has ever performed a criminal profile. Bittaker still recalls his time with Douglas.
Yeah, John Douglas. He thought he was smart. He dressed down for me. He brought another FBI agent, Mary Ellen O'Toole. She was hot. CBS and the FBI were going to produce a show called Criminal Minds, based on my case. That was an hour-long special, prime time. But they weren't allowed to do it because San Quentin wouldn't give them the interview time.
What was your problem with Douglas?
Well, the first thing I mentioned was that he dressed down. He wore denim and a jacket. This guy thinks he's slick. He thought he could fit in with me. He thought calling a woman a bitch in front of me would get me to like him. He thought he could con me. I wasn't saying anything. I can't blame the guy for trying. He was playing little mind games. He used the term bitches. I don't refer to females as bitches.
Be honest with me. Do you have any remorse for killing those girls?
Yes, yes, yes. How many times do I have to tell you? Nobody's gonna believe it. I'm not happy I got caught.
While Bittaker is saying yes, a closer analysis of his response will reveal that he still hasn't shown any true remorse for his actions. He doesn't say that he thinks about the girl's parents and loved ones and what they might be going through. He says, quote, "I'm not happy I got caught." He shows no remorse for what he did, only for getting caught doing it. Bittaker occasionally replies to letters sent to him in prison and signs them with his media-given nickname, Pliers Bittaker, a dedication to his favorite instrument of torture. Bideker was once asked if he ever thinks about his sentence.
Why would I want to think about that? I have it all figured out anyway to commit suicide. Razor blades are sort of messy. I can just black myself out. You just put some pressure on your carotid artery. And if I did that with a wrap of some kind, maybe a belt or a cloth, wrap it around my neck, tighten it with a pencil or something, when your brain is not getting any blood, you're in trouble. I'll just fall out and never wake up.
In exchange for testifying against Bideker, Roy Norris was handed a sentence of 45 years to life, with eligibility for parole in 2010. With regard to the future of his parole possibilities, Norris's probation officer testified in May 1980 that Norris, quote, never exhibited any remorse or compassion about his brutal, hideous behavior toward the victims. The defendant appears compulsive in his need to inflict pain and torture upon women, and that Norris can realistically be regarded as an extreme sociopath, whose depraved, grotesque pattern of behavior is beyond rehabilitation. Norris maintains that while he enjoyed sex with his victims, it was Bideker who wanted to torture and kill the victims, which Norris claims he would never have partaken in without Bideker's insistence.
Norris opted out of his first parole hearing in 2009 because, as he told officials, he was not adequately prepared to show where he would live or work if released. He was automatically denied parole and will not be eligible for another hearing until 2019.
Yikes, that's not far off.
Oh, I wouldn't be too worried about it. As Stephen Kay said, quote, he should never get out, and I don't believe there is any parole board that will ever grant him parole.
Even so, these guys have been quite an inspiration to a number of copycat killers over the years. Just last year in Muskegon County, 47-year-old Jeffrey Willis was arrested after attempting to abduct a teenage girl, and was subsequently linked to the high-profile murders of Rebecca Bletch and Jessica Herringa. Standing trial for the two murders this June, Willis wrote out a list of serial killers which detectives found in his shed. Here's what the prosecutors concluded.
On that list are a couple of individuals who in 1979 abducted and killed five girls. They were called the Toolbox Killers. Now, we've got some evidence to suggest that the defendant was trying to emulate the Toolbox Killers, in my opinion. I think it's really relevant.
5 years after Bideker's trial, Paul Bynum, the lead detective on the case, committed suicide at the age of 39. In a 10-page suicide note, Bynum specifically referred to being haunted by the murders committed by Bideker and Norris. He feared that one day they might be released and hunt down him and his family.
Bynum wasn't the only one haunted by the case. Leah Lamp's mother once told Deputy DA Stephen Kay that she worked two jobs so she would have to stay awake to avoid the nightmare she had of her daughter being tortured. Kay himself has said that for over 2 years after the trial, his sleep was disturbed by a recurring nightmare in which he'd see a girl getting into Bideker's van and he'd run over to stop them, but would, quote, always get there too late.
Today, the infamous recording of Shirley Ledford's torture on Halloween night is used by the FBI Academy to desensitize their agents in training to the raw, horrific realities of torture and murder.
Thank you for joining us for the conclusion of our look at the Toolbox Killers on another episode of Serial Killers. Join us next week as we delve into the mind of Albert Fish. Don't forget to subscribe to Serial Killers on iTunes, SoundCloud, Stitcher, or any other podcast directory, or through our website, parcast.com. That's parcast.com. A new episode of Serial Killers comes out every Monday. Please let us know what you think and join the conversation on our Parcast Facebook page. You can tweet us at Parcast Network. That's P-A-R-C-A-S-T Network. As always, we thank you for listening. Have a killer week.
Serial Killers was created by Max Cutler and developed by Ron Cutler. It is a production of Cutler Media and is part of the Parcast Network. It is produced by Max and Ron Cutler, sound designed by Ron Shapiro, with production assistance by Joel Stein and Maggie Admire. Serial Killers is written by Donnie Goffstein and stars Greg Polson and Vanessa Richardson. The amazing cast of voice actors includes, by alphabetical order, Manu Narayan and Steve Pinto.